I'm Jay Hughes, producer of Change Surfer Radio, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. Speaking today with Brad Allenby, Braden Allenby. Which do you prefer?
Brad's fine.
Brad, okay. Brad is a professor of engineering and ethics at Arizona State University. He's the founding chair of the Consortium for Emerging Technologies, Military Operations, and National Security, which sounds cool. He is the author of The Theory and Practice of Sustainable Engineering, and most recently, The Techno-Human Condition, which he co-authored with Dan Sarewitz, who's also been a guest on our show. And you can find out more about the book at technohuman.net, and that's what we're going to talk about today. So welcome, Brad.
Thank you very much, James. Good to be here.
Now, I thought it was very interesting what you do in this reasonably short book, readably short, is an attempt to stake out a position between transhumanists and bioconservatives and try to contextualize the debate in a way that that moves the debate forward beyond that dichotomy. Is that a correct interpretation?
That's correct. Yeah, a lot of what we were concerned with was whether or not the current positions adequately address the complexity of the coming issues. And so we spent a lot of time working on that part of it, how to think about that complexity, how to maybe characterize it in such a way that we were able to better address some of the issues.
Now, a lot of the book takes pot shots at the Enlightenment in various ways, and I wonder if you could just kind of define the Enlightenment, what you mean by the kind of thing that you're trying to argue against, because I consider myself a partisan of the Enlightenment, even with all its complexity.
Well, and I think Dan and I do too, actually. I think that the main issue we have with the Enlightenment, for purposes of the book, the part of the Enlightenment that we specifically focus on is the part that that looks at applied rationality and sort of the reductionist approach to science, engineering, and human structures. And our point is not that there's not a place for that, because there's a lot of ways in which that approach still works. Our point was that when you start looking at emerging technologies and some of their implications, you need to be able to work in ways that go beyond sort of the applied rationality tools that we have. For example, if you look at what the possible implications of telepathic helmet technology might be, assuming that gets developed, it's very hard to understand what might happen if all you do is look at applied rationality. But if you think about it more broadly and you come up with a set of scenarios, knowing that none of them are right, but that all of them might give you practice in thinking about issues, then you can begin to kind of develop a portfolio of ideas that will help you depending on what actually happens in the real world.
So when you critique Enlightenment rationality, it's really the reductionism, because I think, you know, some people would say that all the forms of rational reflection that you argue for in the book are products of the Enlightenment. You're not arguing anywhere in the book for reliance on revealed authority or, you know, a mystical interpretation of reality. You're saying, you know, build scenarios and think about consequences, and all of those are rationality tools.
That's absolutely right. I don't think it would be anything that we would support that would say, you know, let's all go back and try to understand the world by looking at scratches on turtle shells. That's not what we need. What we do need is to be more accepting of the complexity of the world that we're creating. So you're absolutely right in that what we're trying to do is not move back to before the Enlightenment, but is to try to understand how we can preserve as much as possible of the Enlightenment while being able to address truly complex systems. And it is a process, it's a different rationality in a way, but it is a process of rationality. And I don't think Dan or I would want to move away from that.
Now, another move that you make in the book, which is a characteristic transhumanist point, is that that human beings have always been improving. You say making, using, and improving on technologies is like eating, sleeping, lying, procreating, imagining. It's part of being a person. That education was a process of brain modification, is a process, and you try to blur this notion that human enhancement technologies are somehow novel by pointing out the continuity with all these things we've done before. So, is that correct?
You
basically see it as a continuity.
Sure. And the best way to think about it, depending on how old you are, is to think back to the beginning of the movie 2001, right? There's a huge difference between an ape that is just holding a bone because it's holding a bone and an ape that is holding a bone and knows that it's a weapon. And similarly, I think that Andy Clark's argument that we've always had that unique capability to blend in with our technologies so that what you have is always an integrated system, I think that's a reasonably powerful approach. So the difference really comes down to, do you think that today, for some reason, is different qualitatively than, say, 100 or 200 years ago? And I think that's a much more interesting point, and it's a much more difficult one to be sure of.
So there have been radical discontinuities in evolution. We know the discontinuity between pre-literacy and literacy, or between hunter-gatherer and agriculture. Do you see this moment as that kind of potential discontinuous historical moment?
I think we do, but it was an interesting part of writing the book to talk about that between Dan and I, and also implicitly to query the literature on that, including your books, because what we're asking is there something that is particularly different about this era than the previous examples? And so my position tends to be, well, you know, I think there probably is, and I think it comes down to two fundamental trends. One is that we have the acceleration of technologies across the entire technological frontier. And this is sort of the Kurzweil's argument, but I don't think you have to take it as far as he does. I think it is clear that the technologies are advancing much more rapidly than they have in the past, that they are very potent, and I think that makes at some point a qualitative difference. The second argument is that the human has become a design space in a far more profound way than it ever has before. Now, following up on the Andy Clark point, it's not that we haven't been changing the human all along. It's that now we are developing the capability to change it in far more dimensions and far more fundamentally than we ever have before. So if I take those two trends together, dramatically accelerating technology and the human as design space, my argument would be that we are in a period that is probably qualitatively different than anything that has gone before.
Now, another thing that you want to do, and part of the whole structure of the book, is an argument about the difference between functional use of a tool, the overt use of any particular technology, this which you call level one, and then level two, which is the system of that tool requires in human society, and then level three, which you argue is the global consequences of use and the global context of use. So you then apply that to a couple different examples, but you think that you basically say that a lot of the disagreements over transhumanism are that transhumanists are focused on level one overt utilities of particular technologies, while the critics are focused on level two.
Yeah, and I think you don't want to push any characterization too far, but I think that's fair in the way we look at it, and it has other implications. I mean, let's say that I'm focusing on a particular drug as a cognitive enhancement. It's quite likely that drug is going to work, based on current experience, or assuming we're looking at a new generation of drugs, whichever. So there you can say, well, this is probably a good thing in the limited sense that what it is doing is truly enhancing the individual in the way that it was supposed to and that it was designed to do. Then you get into the sort of level two or level three arguments, level two arguments being kind of the technology network, level three arguments being the earth systems and cultural systems over time kind of level. And the problem with those levels is that a lot of the issues become hypothetical, so that with virtually any technology, no matter how good it is or how bad it is for that matter, I can come up with a hypothetical that will demonstrate that we should never do it. And so you begin to, you have to be careful at that level, because what seems to happen, at least in some cases, is people will come up with a hypothetical scenario showing that a technology might be misused, and then they'll argue that that means it should be banned. And our argument would be, no, that's going way too far in the other direction. You can always generate those hypotheticals. What we need to do is understand better the different levels at which these technologies function and how to try to manage them to optimize the benefits and reduce the risks.
Now, you say that how could someone, let's see, how would you prepare for the railroad if you were an 1820s general store owner in Ohio? And it's an interesting way to kind of frame the moment we might be in, this even more radical moment, the singularity argues that there's like a complete inability to predict what's going to happen in the future. But does that make the effort of anticipatory democracy kind of foolhardy? Because none of us can really see beyond the overt use of a technology and extrapolate what the system, the techno system, and the global consequences are going to be.
Yeah, I'm glad you raised that point, because if all you do is lay out this framework, then it seems to imply that you might as well give up and go home and have a beer. The difference is that I think there are examples and tools that we can use, not necessarily to foresee the unforeseeable. I mean, how these technologies are going to roll out is very difficult to predict with any kind of confidence. But I think what you can do is enable yourself to be better prepared for it. So to take a mundane example, when the electronics industry had to get out of using CFCs because the Montreal Protocol and the damage to the ozone layer, we had a lot of alternate technologies that were on the shelves that had been developed over years, because most of what we used CFCs for was cleaning piece parts, and we had a lot of technologies that could do that. After we had done that, then we were asked to stop using lead solder as an industry. The problem was we didn't have a lot of technologies on the shelf to substitute for lead solder. And in fact, it took a number of decades before we managed to do that as an industry. I think that illustrates the important point that you can develop the ability to adapt much more rapidly and much more in a much more sophisticated way by developing things like option spaces. So if you have a lot of potential options, if something goes wrong, you simply switch to something else. If you don't have a lot of options, then the process is much more difficult and you're liable to build up a lot of unintended costs.
So let's talk about that idea of option spaces. That one of the arguments you make is that we should try not to engage in technological innovation that locks us in ways, but try to use technologies to allow lots of smaller choices along the way and have a more resilient civilization, one that can turn more and have more options.
Right.
So give us another example of that.
Well, so for example, If you look at the way we've approached climate change, we're basically approaching it in two ways. We're approaching it through the Kyoto Protocol process, which argues, let's all just stop emitting because it's not a good thing. And we're approaching it with a suite of technologies called geoengineering technologies that are all big bang, silver bullet kinds of technologies. Put sulfur in the atmosphere, put a screen between us and the sun, that sort of thing. Our argument would be that those approaches, one on the social side and one on the technological side, are ill-advised precisely because they are so big and so difficult to implement and might have such unintended consequences because they're big technologies. Let's say that I do geoengineering at scale, for example. By definition, I am implementing a technology that has the potential to change the climate system. It's ridiculous to assume that that's all it's going to do. It's going to have huge economic impacts, huge social impacts, huge biodiversity impacts, possible mortality impacts. All of these are part of the technology, but they're not looked at because of the unsophisticated way we're thinking about the technology. So if you think about it in a different way and start moving perhaps towards Rob Sokolow's idea of doing a little bit here and a little bit there, the kind of pie chart approach that he takes. If you begin to look at a portfolio of technologies, then let's say that one doesn't work very well. Let's say that you start fertilizing the ocean with iron, and it turns out that the biological impacts on the ocean are simply unacceptable. Well, it means you're not stuck with that technology. It means that you have other options that you can implement. And that's particularly important where technologies are liable to go from a linear regime to a nonlinear regime. An example of that would be biofuels, bioethanol. So, making ethanol from corn is not a bad technology. They've been doing it in the mountains of Virginia for many, many years, and it works just fine, as long as you don't use lead in the piping. But if you do it at large scale very quickly, it has huge nonlinear impacts. So it changes the way agriculture is done around the world. It's part of raising food prices. It causes food riots in the Philippines, political unrest. All of these nonlinear effects, it's not because of the technology, it's because we were stupid in the way we implemented the technology.
So you acknowledge in the book that transhumanists, the broadest set of transhumanists, there are a variety of transhumanists, but most transhumanists imagine a future in which there's going to be free individual choice of the exercise of different kinds of enhancements, and that will result in, hopefully, in a diversity of enhancements, and that's a radically different vision than older authoritarian eugenic visions, which would have implemented, say, widespread genetic engineering of a certain particular type or something. So wouldn't the transhumanist project of creating a liberal and diverse marketplace of options for people to cognitively enhance or pursue different kinds of life extension technologies be an implementation of what you're proposing, which is a more resilient and diverse implementation of technologies?
It could potentially, but it depends on how it's rolled out. Let's say, for example, that what I'm doing is developing a suite of technologies that enable human enhancements of different kinds, and that people get to play with it. Potentially, that kind of program could enhance human well-being without significant social impact. But it could work the other way, too. Let's say, for example, that I develop a cognitive... Let's just look at the use of ADD drugs as cognitive enhancers for example, people who are otherwise reasonably normal, whatever that means, who are taking SAT tests. If I'm in a room of 100 people and two or three people are taking the drugs to enhance their performance, then it's probably not a big deal. But if I'm in the same room and 70 people are, then the individual fades into the community because if I don't enhance myself, then I'm going to be at a disadvantage. So I think a lot depends on how the technologies are developed and how society responds. It doesn't suggest that the development of human enhancements is bad by any means, but it does suggest that it needs to be watched at a number of different levels so that you can try to minimize adverse effects if they begin to happen.
I have argued in Citizen Cyborg that that individual cognitive enhancement would be good for democracy. And that's part of a general class of transhumanist arguments that individual goods can and often do scale up into social goods, so that cognitive, so that, for instance, life extension is both an individual good and could be good for society because we'd have more older people with more wisdom, and older people aren't as violent, and healthy older people don't use as many nursing and healthcare resources, et cetera, et cetera. But right. you seem very suspicious of this notion of a scale-up, and you specifically try to disabuse your readers of the notion that smarter citizens would make a smarter democracy.
Yeah, I think part of it is because it's not clear how, and this gets back to the level one, level two argument. At level one, pretty clearly the enhancements are going to work or have to work. I mean, otherwise you don't enhance, right? I mean, if you do, let's take another example. If you do plastic surgery, in almost all cases, you get a result that you think results in a better looking you, an effective enhancement. And that's fine. But what gets tricky is where that begins to translate into the social level, because it's not clear to me, at least, that we really understand how that works. So let's say, for example, that I begin to develop more intelligent people, but they begin to lose their emotional intelligence, which some would argue is, in fact, what's happening with social networks, Google, and the rise of augmented cognition technology. Is it good or is it bad? I don't think we have enough data to say. So I would not say it's bad. I think that's not justified by the data. But on the other hand, it's not clear to me that it's good, because I don't know how the individual translates into the social level. To take another example.
With that one, you're talking about a trade-off between one kind of good and then a decrement in another area. And let me just also propose that Nick Bostrom has talked about the difference between positional goods and intrinsic goods. So in other words, that there are some goods like perhaps beauty, certainly height, where taller people make more money, they get more social recognition, but if everyone was taller, no one would benefit. And so the risks of whatever that technology might be.
Yeah, you get into an arms race.
Wouldn't be worth it. And then there's these kinds of trade-off arguments. But aren't there some goods, and potentially cognitive enhancement or life extension certain versions of it at any rate, be one of these goods where it is both intrinsically good for every individual, doesn't necessarily have trade-offs, and is not a positional good, but in fact is a general good?
So the argument I would make on that is that it's possible, but it is not necessarily follow as a matter of logic. So take life extension, for example. My personal feeling on life extension is I would be okay with that, and it turns out the older I get, the more okay I would be with that, assuming a high quality of life. The difficulty in that would come from a scenario, say, where you begin to get radical life extension, say, to 150 in developed countries, but you continue the reproductive patterns that we've got now, so that, in fact, what you get is a significant bulge in global population, which begins to raise issues about equity in terms of access to resources, sustainability issues. I'm not saying those aren't manageable, but I'm saying that you begin to get systemic effects which require a lot of attention. So I don't know, one certainly can't say that individual good necessarily translates into social good. But it is also, I think, incorrect to say that individual good does not translate into social good. The kind of argument I'd make is that, and in part this is because I think that these technologies are going to be very, very difficult to stop or to hinder in a major way, particularly globally. That being the case, I think what this begins to do is suggest that we need to become much more adept as a society at understanding these technologies and at developing the ability to adjust gracefully so that we can optimize the benefits from them, because I don't think they're automatic.
I want to point out to the potential reader of Techno-Human Condition that you have a set of principles towards the back of the book fleshed out in a readable way about how one might go about technological anticipation, which I found very interesting because, you know, that's what we're about, the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies, transhumanists in general. But you talk about the need to eschew solutions to things, to focus on option spaces, the importance of pluralism and scenario building. And
right.
And I thought that that was a very useful set of starting points for how you build possible futures. But one of the overall point that you're trying to make with that, it seems, is that too many people focus in a kind of linear way on one particular solution is going to solve everybody's problems, and they know exactly how everything's going to turn out. You want to just argue for a lot more contingency and humility in the area of prediction.
Yeah, and I think in some ways this goes back to your point about the Enlightenment that you brought up, and appropriately so, at the beginning of the discussion. The key to this, I think, is not simply throwing over the Enlightenment. I mean, the Enlightenment has done wonderful things. It has resulted in far more human freedom and a number of valuable aspects of life that none of us would want to give up. The point is to try to build on it, to develop the capability to continue reacting rationally and ethically to a much more challenging and complex future, which is in itself testament to the success of the Enlightenment. If it weren't for applied rationality, science and engineering, social systems, institutions would never have brought us to where we are. So the question now is not just, you know, throw away the Enlightenment and go with mysticism, for example. The question is, how do you build institutions that can continue rational and ethical human progress, but in an environment that is far, far more complex? And we try to offer some ideas about that. Many of them are extensions of Enlightenment ideas. I mean, if you look at institutions that have had to address the kind of unpredictable contingent structures that we're concerned with, you're looking at things, for example, like militaries. And there you have von Moltke back in the 1800s that was developing the ability to react as conditions in the battlefield changed unpredictably. You have the U.S. military and many other world militaries with war games, with scenarios, all of it in effort to try to learn how to grapple with a complex and unpredictable future. And one of the things that we might argue, for example, is those kinds of methods ought to be taken into other parts of the government, other parts of our society, and used to try to develop that flexibility. Because we're not very flexible. I mean, all you have to do is look at American politics right now and you realize that flexibility is not our watchword.
I thought your application of your level 1, 2, and 3 principles to military robotics was particularly interesting, very timely. You know, there's an awful lot of applications of that right now. So we've been speaking with Brad Allenby about his new book co-authored with Dan Sarewitz on the Techno-Human Condition, which is, as you heard, an attempt to parse out some of the issues and ways of approaching the future that transhumanists are very concerned with. Thanks so much for joining us today, Brad.
Thank you, James. I've enjoyed the conversation. Very good points you've raised.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio, a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future, brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies and produced at WRTC Hartford at Trinity College and WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. I'm the host and producer of Change Surfer Radio and the executive director of the IEET, Jay Hughes. If you want to learn more about the techno-progressive perspective of Change Surfer Radio and the IEET, or you want to share your thoughts about our programs, email us at director@IEET.org. Also at IEET.org, you can subscribe to a weekly podcast of Change Surfer Radio and listen to or download all of our shows since 1998, thanks to archive.org and the AInfos Radio Project. Our intro and outro music were composed and recorded by IEET fellow Ricardo Campa. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and radically democratic future.